It's always good to be with you all, and it's always a privilege and a pleasure to share God's portion of God's Word and a portion of my study. If you'll turn with me to John chapter 11, we're going to study verses 1 through 46. We're going to begin by reading verses 1 through 16. John writes, "Now a certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the town of Mary and her sister Martha. It was that Mary who anointed the Lord with fragrant oil and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. Therefore the sisters sent to him, saying, 'Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick.' When Jesus heard that, he said, 'This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified through it.' Now Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. So when he heard that he was sick, he stayed 2 more days in the place where he was. Then after this, he said to the disciples, 'Let us go to Judea again.' The disciples said to him, 'Rabbi, lately the Jews sought to stone you, and are you going there again?' Jesus answered, 'Are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of this world. But if one walks in the night, he stumbles, because the light is not in him.' These things he said, and after that he said to them, 'Our friend Lazarus sleeps, but I go that I may wake him up.' Then the disciples said, 'Lord, if he sleeps, he will get well.' However, Jesus spoke of his death, but they thought that he was speaking about taking rest in sleep. Then Jesus said to them plainly, 'Lazarus is dead, and I am glad for your sakes that I was not there, that you may believe. Nevertheless, let us go to him.' Then Thomas, who was called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, 'Let us also go, that we may die with him.'" It is at this point in the gospel story, there are about 3.5 months that remain in Jesus' ministry. And this story is the 7th of the 7 miracles that John records Jesus performing. The other gospels don't record this event. Some scholars believe it's probably because they weren't there on that occasion, and they were likely still in Galilee. Peter, for example, he lived in Galilee, and he hasn't been mentioned for a little while now, and so we are glad that John provided this account for us. Jesus has been spending time in Perea, and I thought, as we do sometimes, if you look, it's a place we don't talk about much. If you look on map 6 in the Pew Bible, you can see down by the Salt Sea, Jerusalem and Bethany just at the top on the left, and then Perea is across the Jordan River, and it's a province over there, and he's stayed there for some time. And now he is called to come back to Bethany, which was slightly less than 2 miles northeast of Jerusalem. So this would have been around 25 miles where he has been in Perea. The story is about Jesus visiting Lazarus. And Lazarus, of course, is the brother of Mary and Martha. And John references, if you'll notice, John references that this Mary is the one who anointed Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair. And I find that interesting because that's in the next chapter. So we know that the story was probably so well known in the early church that he could use that as a reference. It's sort of like how in Matthew 10 and verse 4 states that Judas Iscariot was the one who betrayed the Lord. It was so familiar that he could use it as a reference. And so this family and Jesus are very close. Jesus stayed in Peter's home when he was in Galilee, and it would seem that while he was near Jerusalem, he would often stay with this family. And when the sisters send for Jesus, they write, "He whom you love is sick." And of course, they probably tried to nurse Lazarus back to health, but when they realize Lazarus is not faring well, they risk calling for Jesus. You know, he had developed quite the reputation as a healer, and they would have also known that it would have been dangerous for Jesus to come back near to Jerusalem, to this area at this time. From their point of view, Jesus would be risking his own life. But they knew his love for the family would win him over. And of course, he had his own special reasons. And there are two different words that I wanted to point out used for love in this story. In verse 3, the letter the sisters wrote to Jesus. And in verse 36, when it says the Jews that are around see Jesus weeping, the word John uses is phileo, like natural affection from a parent for a child. But in verse 5, John uses agape, indicating that this love was resulting from a moral choice. That's how McGarvey phrased it. I kind of liked it. It's a love resulting from a moral choice. So Jesus didn't make this decision because of indifference. He loved this family, and he knew it could be a tremendous teaching moment. And so when Jesus heard the message, he responds to the people around him, "This sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God may be glorified thereby." I have to point out that is the most important sentence in the story. The event is for God to be glorified and for Jesus to be glorified. And if the people around him were paying attention, they would not have questioned his decisions over and over. He stayed in the extra days to show this family and his disciples the most impressive miracle yet. And of course, it tried their patience. It tried their faith. They were, when something is a serious event is happening, I think we all want to get there and help out as soon as we can. That's how the disciples are thinking. But Jesus has other plans. His plan is to perform a miracle to increase people's faith. And he even wanted them to remember this teaching so that they would be ready for when he would die. And again, John writes that Jesus loved this family. And we have to understand from those two verses that even Jesus' love for this family had to take a back seat to the glory of God. And so after his 2 days, he states, "Let's go back to Judea." And which makes the disciples with him also think about the dangers of going there. They remind him, the Jews want to stone you, and you want to go back? Well, he answers somewhat indirectly. And I liked Eric's song a moment ago. The second verse talked about this teaching of Jesus. He says, "Are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble because he sees the light of this world. But if one walks in the night, he stumbles because the light is not in him." So people split time into 12-hour segments back then. You might remember from other stories that there were 4 3-hour watches in the night. Well, Jesus' point is that he has the freedom to go where he wishes because it is still day. The day represents his life. He must work in the daytime. And this is a reference to his explanation from John 9, verse 3 and 4. And several places in Scripture, multiple times in the book of John, Jesus states, "His hour is not come yet." And then finally in chapter 16, he states, "His hour has come." His day would be ending. His life would be ending. But right now, he must continue to work. And so Jesus tells them, "Our friend Lazarus sleeps, but I go that I may wake him up." The word sleep that Jesus uses is the Greek word from which we get the word cemetery. In classical Greek, it's a common metaphor, and Jesus used it regularly, at which point John adds that well-known aside, "Jesus spoke of his death, but they thought he was resting." And so the disciples with him are only thinking about it literally, in a literal sense. And that seemed to be a common mindset among people that day. Rest is, of course, the thing that someone who is sick needs. So that's what they're thinking. And so John writes, "Jesus just spoke to them plainly," which I I had to stop and think, sometimes we all need that. He says, Lazarus is dead, and I'm glad for your sakes that I was not there, that you may believe. Anyway, let's go. And so McGarvey writes that had Jesus been present during his sickness, he would have felt constrained to heal him, and so would have lost the opportunity of presenting to his disciples this more striking proof of his divine power. And so his gladness is not because Lazarus is sick or that he died. It's that he has the opportunity to increase their faith. And so they get ready, everything's ready, and it tells us that Thomas opens his mouth. And yes, this is Thomas, one of the 12 apostles. He's also called Didymus, which means the twin. He's the one who doubted Jesus in John 20 and 24. And I have to think of him kind of as the Debbie Downer of the group, because what he says is kind of depressing, but at the same time, it's a little bit courageous. He says, let us go also that we may die with him. It's kind of courageous, but his thinking wasn't quite along the lines of what Jesus was thinking. He's willing to go with Jesus to Judea, but he's kind of presumptuous in thinking that they're going to die too. And there's two things wrong with this thinking. One, which he wouldn't have known, is that Lazarus was already dead. Because we know this because the Lord expressed it already. And number two, this statement shows no faith in the Lord and his power over death. Thomas was not paying great attention, like we've seen from other disciples that day. He needed to witness the miracle, but as we know, that didn't quite sustain his faith. So let's continue, verses 17 to 27. John writes, so when Jesus came, he found that he had already been in the tomb 4 days. Now Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles away, and many of the Jews had joined the women around Martha and Mary to comfort them concerning their brother. Then Martha, as soon as she heard that Jesus was coming, went and met him. But Mary was sitting in the house. Now Martha said to Jesus, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you. Jesus said to her, your brother will rise again. Martha said to him, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. Jesus said to her, I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, he shall live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? She said to him, yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who has come into the world. Like I said, Perea to Bethany would have been around 25 miles. It would have taken Jesus and company about 2 days on foot to make the trip to Bethany. And it was common for people to be put in the tomb the same day they had died. So Lazarus would have likely, having died 4 days before, Lazarus probably died the day the messengers got to Jesus. McGarvey writes that the resurrections Jesus performed were progressively showing his power. His first resurrection was Jairus' daughter, who was raised immediately after she had passed away. The young man from Nain, who was being carried to his grave, was resurrected out of the box he was in on the way to his grave. And now Lazarus has been buried for 4 days. All these were preparatory to the last and greatest manifestation of resurrection, his own. And many Jews had come to Bethany to mourn and comfort the family. The time of mourning in Jewish custom is much longer than ours in the modern world. We can read that in Numbers chapter 20 and Deuteronomy 34. And McGarvey writes that even in other Jewish writings like the Mishnah prescribes 7 days for near relatives to mourn. And other rules are laid down by other rabbis that require 7 days public and 30 days private of mourning for distinguished and important people. So that, needless to say, they take a long time to mourn and probably do other activities during this time period around this person's memory. So Martha hears that Jesus is near to the town, and she goes out to meet him. And while Mary sat in the house, and McGarvey writes that Jesus evidently paused on the outskirts of town. He probably wished to avoid the noisy conventional wailing, the hypocrisy of which seemed distasteful to him. And we see an example of that from Mark chapter 5 at Jairus' house. He asked the wailers to leave. And so Martha expresses her regret that he wasn't there in time. It's not a chastisement of the Lord. It's just an expression of regret. And then she states, "But even now I know that whatever you ask of God, God will give you." She believes in the power of prayer. But the way she describes prayer gives us a little bit of insight in how she viewed Jesus, because she phrased it as if Jesus had to ask for himself for the power, not that the power was in him. The gospel writers do not allude to his prayers that way. As we continue to read through this gospel in John 14, 15, 16, and 17, there's a lot of verses about Jesus praying. And if you'll pay attention, this is not exactly the type of prayer he prays. The gospel writers show that his prayers were to glorify the Father. They, like this prayer, or the prayer he'll pray later, is appreciation for the Father hearing him. He's asking for others to bear fruit. He's asking for others to come to obedience. And so they focus on relationships and the needs of others. But he doesn't pray for power because God has granted him that already. That's important because she doesn't realize the power is in Jesus, and she does not expect him to raise Lazarus right then. But she almost sees Jesus as a holy man petitioning God. She still has faith because of Jesus and the Father's close relationship. And so they have this loving conversation here. Jesus responds, "Your brother will rise again." And notice the only thing he doesn't mention is the time frame that it would happen in. So this is sort of a test for her. She makes a wonderful confession. "I know he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." But she, again, is not thinking in the immediate context. Even if she had heard someone mention Jesus' words and discussion in Perea, she still did not have a full understanding of what he meant. And he's about to provide amazing proof of what she just said, when on the final great day, all the graves would be opened and the dead will be called forth by the King of Kings. So once again, Jesus has to spell it out very plainly. Jesus loves that she has faith, but he expects her to expand her knowledge. He says, "I am the resurrection and the life." He is saying he has the power to control these things. And then he moves to talking about spiritual life. "He who believes in me, though he may die physically, he shall live spiritually. And whoever lives physically, as in lives in this world, and believes in me, shall never die spiritually." He's telling us that having a relationship with him is so all important, as commentaries like to put it, that it is as if death does not exist. Christ defeated death, and for God's people, physical death, the only death we may experience, will be an uncomfortable transition from this world to the next. That's why Paul could write such passages as Philippians 1 and 21, "For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain." Or 2 Corinthians 5, verse 1, "For we know that if our earthly house, this tent, is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens." And so Jesus asked her if she believed this. And it's interesting, some commentaries say that she kind of dodges the question here. By another confession, she responds, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who has come into the world." Maybe she phrased it that way because she still did not fully understand what he was trying to say. She again confesses faith in him. She believed him. She accepted what he said. And maybe that's all she could say at the moment. She was confessing she had faith, and that's what Jesus wanted. And you know, sometimes that's all we can. Sometimes that's all we can say. Sometimes that's all we can answer with, because we'll find passages and teachings that we don't fully understand, and we have to keep going back to them and studying them and thinking about them. We get in situations where we aren't sure how to act. We have to think about our actions later on, and we'll have questions that we don't have answers to. But all we can do is say to God that I trust you. And keep praying for answers. Keep searching. And also, as is the case with Job in the Old Testament, which demonstrates a great lesson for us, and this question posed here to Martha also shows that the best time to assess our faith and attest our faith is when we are enduring affliction. It is then that many will ask whether God cares or at all, or whether he may be just and fair. And it is then that we need to ask ourselves whether we are really his people and fully trust his will for our lives. I love that this morning Matthew said those are the moments that we need him the most. When we're going through times of questioning our faith, we need to look to him first. And so it is this time of emotional disturbance in the life of Martha that Jesus asked if she believed. She doesn't respond with a mere yes, but a statement of real trust. I know you are the Messiah. And she's like Peter, whom Jesus called blessed because of his confession in Matthew 16 and verse 16. He's blessed because he confessed. She's blessed because of her faith. So let's read verses 28 to 37. John continues, "And when she had said these things, she went her way and secretly called Mary, her sister, saying, 'The teacher has come and is calling for you.' As soon as she heard that, she arose quickly and came to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into the town, but was in the place where Martha met him. Then the Jews who were with her in the house and comforting her, when they saw that Mary rose up quickly and went out, followed her, saying, 'She is going to the tomb to weep there.' Then when Mary came where Jesus was and saw him, she fell down on his feet, saying to him, 'Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died.' Therefore, when Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who came with her weeping, he groaned in the spirit and was troubled, and he said, 'Where have you laid him?' And they said to him, 'Lord, come and see.' Jesus wept. Then the Jews said, 'See how he loved him.' And some of them said, 'Could not this man who opened the eyes of the blind also have kept this man from dying?' So Martha goes to get Mary, takes her quietly to Jesus, to the Lord. She wanted Mary to have a private moment with him, just as she had outside of the town. And she got up quickly and left, but a few others see it, so they join with her. They assumed she was going to the tomb. So it was almost inadvertently they all gather with Jesus. And it seems they genuinely wanted to help rather than being the customary wailers because of how Jesus responds in a moment. And when Mary sees Jesus, she runs to him and falls at his feet, weeping and confessing the same frustration Martha had moments ago. Now, she definitely has a more emotional response than Martha does. I think that shows a little bit of difference in their personalities. They're both women of faith, and then they have different reactions. And see, Jesus sees her and the people who followed. And John writes that he groaned in the spirit. Groaning means that he felt anger, indignation, displeasure. I think we can put it that he was frustrated by so many disciples not having faith, not having a full understanding of what he has been explaining over and over to them. He's also probably upset by the result of sin on the world, because he sees his adopted brothers and sisters weeping because of the effects of sin. And he's troubled by seeing their pain. And he asks where they laid him. And that's not a rhetorical question. It's not a question for information, but one asked to bring everyone together to the tomb with him. So we can call it a leading question. It's sort of like the woman with the infirmity who touched the hem of Jesus' garment, and he asks, "Who touched me?" We all know he knew who touched him, but he's asking to have a teaching moment there. Or like at the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus turns to Philip and he asks him, "Where are we going to buy bread?" And then all of a sudden, all the disciples, it dawns on them, "Oh, these people have not eaten for 3 days. We should take stock of what we have." And that's a leading question to get them thinking about what they have. And so he performs his miracle. And so they take him, and he takes his moment for himself, his emotional moment, and he weeps. He sheds tears of sympathy. He understood their pain, and he felt it. He could understand from their perspective how painful it was to lose someone, especially so young. The scriptures record that Jesus wept 3 times, once here, once in the Garden of Gethsemane before his crucifixion, and once in Luke 19 and verse 41, it says that he approached Jerusalem one time, and he wept for it because of how far it had fallen and the troubles that were coming. He wept for his city. But this was his friend, and who had 2 heartbroken sisters and many friends. And we can see he certainly cares for every disciple. And those followed could see, they too knew he could have healed Lazarus. And the people still questioned, criticized, really, could not this man who healed the blind kept Lazarus from dying? So now let's continue on, verses 38 to 44. John writes, "Then Jesus, again groaning himself, came to the tomb. It was a cave, and a stone lay against it. Jesus said, 'Take away the stone.' Martha, the sister of him who was dead, said to him, 'Lord, by this time there is a stench, for he has been dead 4 days.' Jesus said to her, 'Did I not say to you that if you would believe, you would see the glory of God?' And they took away the stone from the place where the dead man was lying. And Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, 'Father, I thank you that you have heard me. And I know that you always hear me. But because of the people who are standing by, I said this, that they may believe that you sent me.' And when he had said these things, he cried with a loud voice, 'Lazarus, come forth.' And he who died came out bound hand and foot with grave clothes, and his face was wrapped with a cloth. And Jesus said to them, 'Loose him and let him go.'" So Jesus groans again in his spirit as they're all approaching the tomb. And I think this really shows that Jesus has his own frustrations. And they stem from, again, his disciples' unbelief. When he commands the stone to be removed, Martha speaks up instantly, almost in protest. At this point, he stinks. It's been 4 days. McGarvey writes that her words show how little expectation of a resurrection as she had. So here is where Jesus makes his teaching moment to everyone. He addresses Martha, but you know everyone is listening. He says, "Did I not say to you that if you would believe, you would see the glory of God. So he's given her some time to think about his words as they've walked over to the grave and they remove the stone. And Jesus prays to the Father a prayer of appreciation for hearing him and recognizing that this moment is for the people around him to increase in faith. And the Father obviously agreed that Jesus wished to raise Lazarus. And his prayer showed that Jesus was not acting necessarily independent of himself, but with God. He still had the power in himself to perform it. But this is a fact that so many Jews of that time refused to believe. They refused to believe that he was the Son of God and that he had power to do these things. McGarvey writes that rationalists criticize that this prayer violates Jesus' teaching in Matthew 5, verse 5 and 6, the Sermon on the Mount, when he states that while praying, not to stand in the corner like the hypocrites and proclaim everything to be seen by others, but go into private and to pray secretly. That's not the intent of his prayer. The intent of this prayer itself is to lead others to the Father. It's not self-centered. It's giving glory to God. And so he cries loudly, "Lazarus, come forth." And notice he simply called to him. He didn't use anything. He didn't touch him. Just like how several scriptures tell us it'll happen on the last day. He'll call forth everyone. And people were often buried in caves or their own rock-hewn sepulchres. Stones, usually disc-shaped, would be rolled into the groove as a makeshift door or a seal, protecting its contents from animals, the elements, and the occasional robber. And the body would be wrapped and left lying on the floor in the tomb's antechamber. After about a year, when the flesh has rotted off, would the family members return to collect the bones in a box, which they would then slide into a slot on the wall. And after 4 days, as it says, decomposition would be well underway, especially because it's no longer winter. Whatever spices or seasonings they may have used to delay the stench would no longer be effective. And the deceased would be wrapped in long cloth strips. And this wrapping was, as much as they could afford, would be as thorough as they could, binding the limbs to keep them straight, and even around the cheeks to keep the mouth shut. The face cloth may have been about a yard square. This tight wrapping would have made it hard enough for a living person to walk, much less someone who has just come back from the dead, and to leave the tomb. It makes me think of when Jairus' daughter was resurrected. She had been sick for some time. She was probably weak. Immediately after her resurrection, Jesus tells them to give her food. I imagine that Lazarus was probably pretty weak, which just those difficulties further underline the miraculous nature of the event. And it's also said that men could not wrap women's corpses, but women could wrap both men and women. So Lazarus may have even been wrapped by his sisters. And we can see a lot of these details of these burial details even at the event of Jesus' resurrection. And so with Lazarus being wrapped up in his grave clothes, I don't know if I could put it this way, he may have hopped or waddled out of there, out of the tomb, and Jesus states, "Loose him from the clothes." They do, and many of the people there believed in Jesus. So let's read the last two verses. It says, "Then many of the Jews who had come to Mary and had seen the things Jesus did believed in him. But some of them went away to the Pharisees and told them the things Jesus did." So you can see how far reaching the influence of the Pharisees went. Even to small towns and good families, news from all over the country, they would hear about it. And there were a few Pharisees that were friendly to Jesus, but the actions from the people that day showed that there were a few that were hostile to him. And fortunately, I like that it says that, or that it's recorded that Jesus won over them, won over a few of them that day. And we forget sometimes that there are people like that in the world. No matter what proof, evidence, logic, argument, whatever you can present to them, it's not going to change their disbelief. We just have to remember, all we can do is continue to try. Keep preaching the word. You know, with such an incredible miracle being done this close to Jerusalem, you know the Jewish rulers are definitely going to hear about it very soon and continue to bother Jesus and his disciples. And we'll see the Pharisees' reactions, hopefully next weekend, through the rest of the chapter. And just as even as we're reading through this, you can really feel the conflict is about to come to a head. And I have one last point, that because of verse 46 and verse 53, it feels as though Jesus coming here and doing this was orchestrated for the Pharisees' benefit as well. They kind of remind me of how Pharaoh's heart was hardened because of his pride, and it was always an economic or a personal reason with Pharaoh that caused him to harden his heart. And their hearts are hardening because of their pride every step that Jesus takes, which will inevitably lead him to the cross. It's like Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians 2, verse 7 to 9, "But we speak the wisdom of God in a mystery, even the hidden wisdom which God ordained before the world unto our glory, which none of the princes of this world knew, for had they known it, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. But as it is written, I hath not seen, nor ear heard, nor have entered the heart of man the things which God hath prepared for them that love him." Paul calls people like this carnally minded in that chapter. But I like to think that everyone here is more spiritually minded. I'm thankful for that. You wouldn't be here on Sunday afternoon if you weren't. We're here because we have the desire to be in a good relationship with God. We can look at this story for encouragement for our own future, even past this physical life. But I still need to ask, if there's one here who knows they're not a Christian and would like to become one, consider doing so. If you are a Christian and you've sinned again, made a mistake, please correct it. Please correct your relationship with God. If anyone needs our help, please come while we stand and sing.